This is the Post Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. I'm your host, Post Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Mikko, and I'm joined in studio today by the PG's Dejan Kovacevic and 93.7, The Fan late shift host Chris Muller. Guys, on this week's show, we're going to take a look at the Penguins as they make a couple of trades this week to try to shore up their injury-plagued lineup. We're also going to take a glance at Pitt basketball off a big win on Thursday night against West Virginia, and we warm up with a little Pirates Grapefruit League discussion. Their first game was Friday against Manatee Community College. But, Dejan, I'm going to start with the two trades the general manager Ray Shero made in the last week. Is that enough to get this team over the hump and nail down a top-four playoff spot? I mean, that's their goal at this point. I don't know if they can catch the Flyers, but they can hold off Washington and maybe keep that number four spot. Or is there one more trade that they may make? They have until Monday to make it. Is there someone else out there they might be looking at?
Well, Shero strongly indicated after the Kovalev trade that he'd be looking for one more. I'd be surprised if they weren't looking for another rent-a-player type, maybe a bringing R.J. Umberger home sure would be nice on a lot of levels. And I say that as someone who's known R.J. since he was a kid. It'd be amazing to see him in a Penguins uniform, even if just for a couple of months. Is this enough to nail down a playoff spot? I think the math is in their favor right now anyway. If they have a decent road trip, Buffalo is the ninth-place team right now. Buffalo is the first team that they face when they come back from the trip. I think it's enough to make the playoffs. The question is, is it enough to succeed in the playoffs?
Well, and my point was the top four spot. Can they nail down a top four spot with as constituted right now?
A lot of it's predicated, I think, on how well Marc-Andre Fleury continues to play. The thing that really is going to hurt them now is they were dealing to make that trade for James Neal, Matt Niskanen, from a position of perceived strength and health, relatively speaking, and that was the blue line. And with Goligoski being traded, then Orpik going down with an injury, Paul Martin still, he's banged up. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of guys on that team that are playing a little bit banged up. I think that's going to be what tells the story for the Penguins, how well they're able to cope with the injuries and with players missing for significant periods of time on that blue line.
Well, guys, someone who sees the Penguins every day and covers them for the Post-Gazette, Shelly Anderson's joining us by phone. Shelly, thanks for taking the time to join us on the roundtable.
My pleasure. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Shelly, we were talking about, you heard us talking about the trades. Do you think that there's maybe one more that Ray Shero is out there trying to make? He has till Monday to do it.
Yeah, I think he's looking. I don't think he's coming from a sense of desperation. I think if it happens, it happens. And if not, he indicated he'd be okay with what they've got, with at least most of the guys that are out coming back at some point sooner rather than later. Certainly, he talked about defensemen, but they're right now they're really at a premium. So I think maybe another scorer would be great for this team. But whether he can swing that or not, we'll have to see, because everybody else is going to be scrambling for that as the deadline approaches too.
Right, same stuff. Is there a salary cap issue too, Shelly? Or are they? I was never a great math student, but are they up against the cap?
They've got some room, and they'll have some more as some of the younger players get sent back down. And their players that are injured come back, and that's going to happen really soon. They expect at least two or three guys back by Wednesday's game, and there's not a game between Saturday night and Wednesday night, which includes the trade deadline. So they're going to have not $3 or $4 million. I don't think it'll be to that extent. I don't know if they want to get right up against the cap that close. But they're going to have a little room to do something, whether it's going to be a high-impact player. We'll see. Remember, Billy Guerin was making $2 million when they brought him in 2 years ago, but Alexei Kovalev is making $5 million. So I don't think they can go with another Kovalev route, but there'll be room to bring someone in if he can get the right terms.
Shelly, you mentioned bringing in another maybe offensive, another scorer. What I'm concerned about, or what I'm wondering, is without an elite playmaker like a Crosby or Malkin to really command attention from the other team's defense and even from their back-checking forwards, how much of an impact can any kind of scoring winger or even a center bring to this team?
Well, I think if you look at some recent games they've played, some recent close games, they've played some games where they were really doing pretty well and they were actually creating a lot, but they didn't have someone to finish. And that's where the addition of a Kovalev, maybe James Neal as he gets a little more accustomed, and someone else they might bring in. So, yes, I think the answer is yes. I think someone can make an impact.
We're speaking with Shelly Anderson, Penguins beat writer for the Post-Gazette. Shelly, you mentioned James Neal. He looks the part. He's a big, strong guy. Looks like he's a big, strong guy. He has a really nice wrist shot, very fast. gets it off in a hurry. I mean, they gave up a lot. In my mind, they gave up a very good young offensive defenseman, a guy that can move the puck. But is that a deal that they made, and you think that's they gave up the right guy to do that deal to get Neil?
I think so. I think that you know, the old saying is you have to give up quality to get quality, and the fact that they got James Neal and a defenseman, Matt Niskanen, who, you know, we'll see how he works out, but certainly there's a little extra incentive to make that trade when you get a second guy and a guy that can, at least to begin with, step in and be one of your top six defensemen as Goligoski was. Alex Goligoski can be a bigger role player in a different team without a Chris Letang and a Brooks Orpik, and I think that appealed to him and appealed to Dallas, and I think the Penguins got a good return because they really needed more scoring punch, more than they needed Alex Goligoski, as good as his potential is.
Shelley Dejean, watching Matt Niskanen's debut the other night, there were some things that looked like they were pretty promising, and then there was the hideous giveaway in overtime. He got beat the one time, one-on-one, had to pull the guy down. What's your impression of whether or not he can stick as a top-six guy with the Penguins?
I think the jury's still out, but I do think that, you know, I sense strongly that there was some sort of a confidence issue. You know, sometimes it takes defensemen a while to really get accustomed to this league. Chris Letang went through a problem with confidence, with kind of getting his confidence and being strong both offensively and defensively and comfortable with how those roles mesh. And I think that Matt Niskanen came up and had such a good rookie season at such an early age that he kind of needs to get past that. And everyone seems to think that a change of pace, a change of scenery, you know, a change of teams could help lead to that, but it's probably not something that's going to happen overnight. He needs to really get comfortable with the system. That's something that apparently takes a little bit of time with this system. So we're going to have to see. You know, if not, they could be in some trouble, but they've got a couple of guys, a couple of prospects who might be able to step in and let Niskanen play a seventh defenseman role if need be. But I think they really want to give him every chance to be a top six defenseman and work toward that before the playoffs start.
Shelley, obviously the other move that the Penguins have made thus far is to bring in former player Alexei Kovalev. Gotten a lot of the fans that remember well the late 90s, early 2000s, very excited about the way he could produce because he still has the great shot, still can create his space and basically get off his own shot without any help from anyone else. How much of an impact do you see him having, especially in light of the fact that he has struggled in terms of point production until recently with Ottawa?
Yeah, I'm really curious to watch this one. And I think that coming back here and getting out from under what was going on in Ottawa is going to be a big adrenaline boost for Alexei Kovalev. I think that's something that at least in the short term could really give him a spark. I thought Ray Sherrill made a great point when he talked about the trade shortly after it happened. He kind of likened it to Bill Guerin 2 years ago, going back to that scenario. But Billy Guerin was really stagnating with the New York Islanders. They were not going anywhere. He was just not very effective. And he came here on a team that was contending, a team that had a lot of unity, a team that had a good system, and really helped them on the Stanley Cup run. And there's every chance that Alexei Kovalev could do that. There's a risk, no question, but the price that they gave up, a sixth or seventh rounder, depending on the situation, was certainly worth it. I think it was far worth it to see if maybe he can recapture a little bit of that. We'll have to remember that he's 10 years older now. But you know, him, even at 38, at his best, could be really helpful for this team.
We're talking with the Post-Gazette's Penguins beat writer Shelley Anderson here on the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Shelley, I want to just do a real quick follow-up on Kovalev. You know, Dan Bylsma runs a system, and he's pretty he wants to run his system. Is Kovalev fit in that, or is this a situation where they just really need some scoring punch, and that's what this guy does?
I think they're going to fully expect him to adapt his game to the system. That's going to be, you know, that might be a little difficult for him, but maybe that adrenaline kick I was talking about will, you know, he's certainly not an unintelligent hockey player. I think he's certainly capable of looking at a system, seeing how it works, and it'll be up to him to decide whether he wants to do that hard work that goes with this system. But, you know, the system is designed to produce a lot of offensive zone time, and that plays right into his hand, and I think he's smart enough to realize that.
Is Ray Sherrill, when he's thinking, he's made the two deals, he might make another, he's got some time certainly, he's got a couple days. Is he doing all this with in mind that he's going to have Sidney Crosby back for the playoffs, do you think?
I think he's being real smart and doing it with the idea that he doesn't know whether Sidney Crosby is going to come back or not. He wants to give this team, you talked about, you know, trying to finish in the top four and get home ice the first round. He wants to see the team do that and be set up well enough to do that whether Sidney Crosby comes back or not. And he wants a team that can make some noise in the playoffs whether Sidney Crosby is back or not. Whether that's really feasible, we'll have to see. But he's doing his best to look at both options. I'm really, you know, really impressed with the way that he's gone about it and what he's gotten, and look at the team and see how it is with and without Sidney Crosby. Certainly having him back will make all the difference in whether they can make a long one in the playoffs. But he's setting this team up to be a pretty decent playoff team if you look at what other teams around the league are set up to be.
Shelley, I have another question about it, and I'm going to touch on the Crosby situation. Is he around a lot? Do you guys see him a lot? Does he come to practice? Does he go to games? I know that, you know, pretty much there, you know, the Penguins have said there's no change in his condition, and I know concussions are funny like that. They may go for weeks without a change, and all of a sudden he's fine. Is he around a lot?
Well, that's two different questions. Is he around or not, and do we see him a lot? Yes, he's around a lot. No, we don't see him a lot, and that's because he wants it that way. He's such a routine guy and so into the team. He's not traveling with the team, but when they're at home, he's at the rink. He's still doing some light workouts, and he wants to do that within the context of when the team's around. But he does kind of make himself scarce whenever there are reporters around. I think he doesn't want to be inundated with questions, and he doesn't want to be, you know, doesn't want to take focus away from the rest of the team and the teammates who are playing. But he's around. I mean, he's functioning. He's not closed in a dark room, sensitive to light, and not being able to do things. He's certainly not to that extent. And if you do casually kind of get to ask him how you're doing briefly, he basically says the same thing. He's doing a little bit better, but, you know, not ready to progress. So he's around, and I'm sure this is difficult for him, but he doesn't show that.
Well, Shelley, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. Thanks for the knowledge, and we appreciate the insight.
Thanks very much for having me, guys.
Okay, that was Shelley Anderson, Penguins beat writer for the Post-Gazette. Up next, we're going to talk about Pitt basketball. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back. I'm Jerry Mitko, and I'm with the Post-Gazette's Dejan Kovacevic and 93.7 The Fan, a late shift host Chris Muller. Guys, time to talk a little Pitt hoops off of a big win Thursday night at home against West Virginia. Pitt now essentially has the double bye. This is a new phrase. This, I guess, gets you into Thursday's round of games at the Big East tournament instead of having to play on Tuesday or Wednesday. So, Chris, I'll start with you. Let's fast forward just a little bit. They're going to win the Big East regular season. Is that enough, regardless of how they do in the Big East tournament, to get them a number one seed in the NCAA tournament?
Well, I guess I'm still not willing to say that they're going to win. They're going to be in that top four, and they'll likely win the Big East. It seems regular season wise they'll win it. I think so, and maybe it's not so much. And everyone's like to put out the logic that they're going to be the best team, more than likely in the best conference in the country, so that should get them the bid. It's the fact that when at one point in time when they were ranked fourth in the country, and they still are, and I believe the AP poll. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, they had 6 wins against the RPI top 20. The 3 teams ahead of them combined had 6 wins. A team like Texas that was ahead of them, that was maybe ahead of them on the one seed line, they had already beaten on a neutral court. Fact of the matter is, aside from the Tennessee game, which is something of an aberration because we know what Tennessee has been like this year, completely up and down, they don't even have something that even sniffs or approaches a bad loss. 1 point to St. John's at Madison Square, where St. John's is like a top 10 team given their resume so far this year, and a tough home loss to a very good, you know, Notre Dame team that probably will be on the 2 or 3 line of this tournament. I think they're absolutely under consideration for a 1 seed, and in my opinion, maybe the number 1 overall seed.
Mm-hmm. They have to be under consideration. At the same time, I'd like to see them at least get to the final of the Big East tournament. There's such a prestige, and rightly so, attached with that tournament. If they get knocked out in the quarters, I can't see the NCAA committee saying, you know, let's make them a number 1 seed. That's going to be tough for them. I like what they've done. I like what they've done against good competition. And I think the NCAA is also going to weigh how very good they've been on the road. One of the best teams in the whole NCAA.
Well, I think it's their body of work in a regular season. I don't know that the tournament, even a loss in the quarters, is going to have that much of an impact unless a team that's on the two line wins their tournament, and maybe they say, well, maybe we need to bump them up and move Pitt down.
The only scenario I can see where Pitt would get bumped down to a two is if Notre Dame runs the table for the rest of the season and in the Big East tournament. But I think if Pitt even gets to that point, that quarterfinal game with the same three-loss record, 28-3, I guess they'd be in lose. I think they would get a one seed. What Dejan said that I love is, and Luke Wynn, who writes for SI, does his power rankings, and he had Pitt number one. A lot of the power rankings this week have Pitt at number one, even after a loss to St. John's. He talked about how Pitt has the least precipitous drop of any Big East team, and it's by a wide margin in terms of their home efficiency and road efficiency overall as a team.
And that means something if you consider that for years now, people have been saying, well, Pitt's really good because they've got this incredible home court advantage. Mm-hmm. And they do have the home court advantage. Now they've just carried it over with them on the road.
And that's what the tournament committee, that's what the seeding committee looks at. That advantage that barely drops at all for Pitt, such that it's still, they're the best road team in the Big East, even though like Syracuse is an aberration, is better on the road than at home. The tourney committee looks to see how you play away from your own building. And when you consider that one of those two away losses, one of them's to Tennessee in the CONSOL Energy Center, and one's by 1 point in Madison Square Garden to one of the best home teams in the country, I don't see how you can't look at this team and say, they're built as a number one. And if they get that Newark region, by the way, that is a huge boost to them because that nullifies some of the theoretical Duke home court advantage that they get if they're playing in Newark.
Right. Speaking of road games, tomorrow, Sunday, they play Louisville, at Louisville. Always a tough place to play and a good team. What do you guys look for in that game? I mean, that should be a good game. That's going to be a test for Pitt. But if they can go on the road and win that game, I think it goes back to the previous conversation. It's another huge road win for them.
Yeah, I think you'd be pretty much you'd be coming close to locking up if not entirely doing it. You know, if Pitt plays the way they did last night, where they're very spread out in their offense, it wasn't just Ashton Gibbs. In fact, Ashton Gibbs really wasn't that much of a factor in it. It wasn't just Brad Wanamaker. It was Lamar Patterson, for heaven's sake, was coming off the bench making plays. You saw them getting the ball inside when they needed to Gary McGee. Gilbert Brown finally started to wake up a little bit. I think you're going to see Pitt find a way to diversify their offense a little bit more and go into the tournament in the best possible shape. That's been, for me, the number one concern this season, is seeing that at times they would look like a good inside team but only against bad opponents. When they succeeded against good teams, it was almost always because of outside shooting. They need to be able to do both.
Mm-hmm. One of the guys that you didn't mention who actually led the team in scoring in that West Virginia game is Nasir Robinson, who had 15. He is
he's the key to that, I'm describing here. Yeah.
He is the definition of efficiency. If he was 6'10", with the skills he has around the hoop at actually finishing, using his body to shield defenders, he would be in the NBA already because his only weakness or flaw is that he's 6'5".
And he's
forward.
Inconsistent.
He's been inconsistent, but he's averaging almost 9 a game this year. And what I really do like, if you want to talk about upward ticking towards the NCAA tournament, is over the last 5, he's averaged 12 a game. That's legitimate inside scoring. And he can finish out to 8-9 feet, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's about twice the effective range of Gary McGee. The one thing I'm looking for against Louisville, who you know will press, you know will try to force mistakes and errors, is to see if Pitt does what they've done for the most part against a press. And they've made the extra pass, look to the middle. I've seen them turn the ball over and gotten a little bit angry, but Louisville's the team that always forces them into up and down games. I want to see them play their style.
That press thing, I've heard that argument. I don't buy it. To me, if I have seen Pitt turn the ball over as well on the press, but if they were that bad against the press, don't you think everybody would be doing it?
No, I don't disagree that they're bad. I don't want to say they're bad against the press, but in the history of looking at games against Louisville, just the way Louisville decides to press, St. John's was pressing, but it was like a soft press trying to trap, like sneak you into a trap.
Right.
Louisville's going to be right in your face, like the Nolan Richardson almost 40 minutes of hell type of press.
Well, stuff Duquesne does.
Right. I would like, well, with better athletes, with
better athletes.
I would just like to see them be able to break that press, and then I'll feel like, because Louisville's always that one team that bothers me when I watch Pitt play them. If they do that, I'll really feel confident in this team's ability.
You know, Ashton Gibbs is back. He didn't have a particularly great game against West Virginia Thursday night, but he is back. There's a combo here. Ray Fittipaldo wrote in the Post-Gazette earlier this week that their offensive production was down in the last 7 Big East games. Now, they had 71 against West Virginia. That's the first time or second time, I think, in eight games they've been over 70 points. Now they've got Gibbs back. Gibbs was there for four of those seven games. Do you think sometimes, and last night was a, Thursday night was an aberration, is it, do they sometimes look to Gibbs a little bit too much? And they've got guys that can score a little bit, like Robinson and Brown, and Wanamaker can score a little bit too?
No, because he's their best shooter, and he's their best scorer. He's the guy that can fill it up the fastest because he can shoot the three. The one thing that he did, that Gibbs did, that I liked in that West Virginia game was he only took eight shots, and once he wasn't making threes, he didn't force the issue. I don't think that I don't think the fact that he's back actually hurts them and is negative at all. They have varied scores. Nasir Robinson's going to make the spin move or get the dirty baskets around the hoop. Gilbert Brown, I can't figure him out. It's just what, fifth year in the program.
He can't figure him out.
He can, you know, make shoot three or four from three and have an elevator highlight reel dunk, and then the second half with foul trouble disappear. You know, Ashton Gibbs and the way this team plays does not really yield. Or does not really allow for a guy to try to take over the game by himself. I don't think that's going to be to their detriment that he's back, that they'll look to him too much.
You know what I liked about Pitt as it relates to Gibbs in the West Virginia game was that they didn't force shots to him. They didn't force passes to him, and he didn't force shots. And you saw them spread the ball out a little bit more. You know, with where they get into trouble, and that goes back to the St. John's game, is when they are forcing it to Gibbs, or he starts dishing it off to Gilbert Brown for threes and things start looking really sloppy.
See, I'm glad you brought that up because, and you said things start looking sloppy when Gilbert Brown's the one shooting
exactly.
him, maybe.
Or Trayvon, for that matter.
I have like, I guess, a love-hate relationship. I like the fact that guys like Woodall and Brown aren't afraid to shoot the shots, but in the St. John's game, I know that Gibbs is the best shooter. You want him or Wanamaker, generally speaking, taking the shots. There were times, though, where I felt like Pitt did pass up an open shot, and maybe most people are saying, okay, good, it's Gibbs that's going to get the ball. I'd rather have any Division I player shooting an open shot than passing it to a covered man who has to shoot. And I think they might do – I think they did that because he was shooting well in that game.
Yeah.
That's the reason.
I think – I'll tell you a guy who I think doesn't get – a lot of notice on that team, who I think is a really good basketball player, is Brad Wanamaker. I think he does a lot of good things for them.
Well, he's sure getting a lot of love on my blog, Jerry. Well, I mean, I've called him MVP from day one. I think he's the glue that holds the team together.
You don't hear a lot about him.
No, and you're not going to hear about too many guys that aren't considered to be NBA draft types. I mean, he doesn't. The next person that starts talking about him with the same pedigree as, say, a Kemba Walker or someone like that will be the first.
Know.
At the same time, you saw Ray Fittipaldo's note the other day that teams are starting to look. NBA teams are starting to pay attention, not just to Wanamaker, but also to Gibbs.
I think Wanamaker's got the better pro prospects of those two, just to mention them briefly, because I think he's shown enough that he could play a little point guard.
He
can play, and he's just a flat-out good player. The thing I love is Gibbs is their best scorer, like shooter, and Gibbs is the one most likely to fill it up with 30, 33 points in a game if need be. Mm-hmm. If you're asking me who do I want with the ball in his hands, with the game on the line, shooting a shot, it is Brad Wanamaker. I have followed this team probably, honestly, closer than any other team in the city. It's kind of like my pet project since about 1999, the Willard era. And he, when he came in as a freshman, drove me nuts. Drove my friends nuts that went to Pitt, everybody. Just the human turnover. The way he's matured is not only a testament to his work ethic, but to what Jamie Dixon does. And he's their best player. Yeah,
he always has options for himself. That's why you want the ball in his hands at the end. He always has multiple options.
He has more lines that are pretty close, like sneaky close to a triple-double than any player in college basketball. 11, 8, and 7 against West Virginia. And it's quiet, too. That's the crazy thing. He just plays the game well. I hate to speak in that kind of a generality, but that's what he does. He's just good.
No, he's fun to watch. I mean, for me anyway, I mean, I don't consider myself a basketball expert, that's for sure. I watch a lot of games, but I just think he's sometimes he's unsung on that team. So, the Pitt plays Sunday at Louisville. Should be a good game, and you're right, Louisville's going to bring some defense at them. It should be a pretty tight game, too. All right, guys, up next, we're going to talk about the Pirates. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jerry Mikko, and joining me are the PG's Dejan Kovacevic and 93.7 The Fan late shift host Chris Muller. Dejan, I'm going to start this with you, this Pirates segment. Earlier this week, Bob Nutting told the team anything less than a pennant is unacceptable. Frank Coonley made a veiled charge that fans should show up in greater numbers if they want ownership to invest more in the team. Ron Cook on the Vinny and Cook Show and on KDK TV said he feels like the Pirates have insulted our intelligence once again. You covered this team for 7 years for us. You still keep an eye on them and do some work on, with them. What do you think? I mean, is this just something that, you know, it gets a bee in our bonnet every year and we talk about it, or is this a legitimate complaint?
Well, it's been discussed every year is my first answer. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that Nutting or Coonley said that was new. Nutting and Coonley and Neil Huntington have all repeated again and again and again that they're not interested in 82 wins. They won a championship. They didn't say in 2011. Bob Nutting didn't say he wanted a pennant in 2011. But they said that that's the goal, that that's the way they're building the system, that's the way they're building the team. They're not looking for short-term moves or gratification. As far as Frank Coonley's charge, here again, I understand there's been a big fuss kicked up over this. This isn't news in the slightest. Frank Coonley spoke this to us in his entrance interview whenever he was introduced as team president in fall 2007, that their philosophy was going to be that they were not going to engage in deficit spending on the payroll. As a result, what they wanted to do was to build up a good, quality young team that would then bring fans to the ballpark, that would increase revenues, that would increase payroll, that would dovetail with the young team being ready for an increase in payroll, meaning a meaningful one, not adding Lyle Overbay, and then having, in their minds, a real contender. Now, they can be, if you're going to criticize the Pirates on this point, criticize them for not having the capital to deficit spend. Criticize the ownership for being undercapitalized or unwilling to deficit spend, because that is how some owners would do it. That's how they're doing it in Cincinnati. That's how they're doing it in Milwaukee. They're paying essentially out of their own pockets, figuring, well, then we're going to bring in the crowds. Then we're going to have more consistent payroll. And then we're going to contend year after year. The Pirates say that they are not in a position to do that. So, again, nothing particularly new or newsy here. This has been their approach from day one.
Just the old catch-22 frustration, or I should say it's a catch-22 situation for the Pirates, I guess, or rock in a hard place, whatever you want to call it. Because if they tell the truth, or what you just said, if they say we're not willing to deficit spend or anything like that.
Yeah, it sounds horrible.
It sounds horrible. And by the same token, you look at Bob Nutting's statements that we want to win a National League pennant. It sounds horrible to the fans that don't see enough progress to even consider that a realistic possibility. But if he says we want to slowly build up and get something going, fans say, well, where's the dedication to a championship?
But you know what else sounds horrible? Right, you know what else sounds horrible, Chris? When Kevin McClatchy tells everybody they're $30 million in debt and, oh, no, the future of the franchise is in doubt.
That's
so
why I say rock
that argument runs both ways.
Yeah, I understand. It's why it's a rock and a hard place. They're damned if they do, damned if they don't, really.
Let's bring in someone who is with the Pirates right now and is the beat reporter for the Post-Gazette, Colin Dunlap. Colin, thanks for taking the time to join us down in Bradenton.
Sure, no problem. How are you?
Good, thanks. You know, Colin, I'll take the question and phrase it a little differently, frame it a little differently for you. You know, this stuff goes on off the field, and it becomes talking points here in Pittsburgh and everything. Do the players and Clint Hurdle's a new manager and he's got a fairly fresh coaching staff there, and you know, does that really affect them? Or do the players ever talk about, you know, we're talking about money again and we're not spending money and we need to get more players? I mean, do you ever hear any of that kind of talk in the locker room?
You know, I don't think. You know, I haven't heard any of it. I think that their tunnel vision is sort of funneled into what they're doing on the field and not necessarily what their paychecks look like. You know, I haven't been around this all that long. Dejan could probably speak to it more. The point that he made, I thought, that was brilliant was the proactive spending, and that other teams are doing that. And if there's a fault to be found, maybe that's the fault. But sort of the news value in all of this, I'm not seeing it either. But to your point, I don't think I think whenever the count's 1-2 and it's a third inning and there's a guy on second base, it's like the furthest thing from people's mind. That's just what I extract from all of this.
You know, the closest that I can recall, Colin, Jerry, and Chris, to players over the past few years talking about payroll or things like that is whenever it comes to arbitration time, whenever it's themselves, other than a 1 or 2 veteran guys complaining, you know, well, what do you expect for $40 million or $45 million? It's been really rare. Colin definitely has the right feel in Bradenton right now. Players get focused on what they have to do to win a game.
We are with the PG's Colin Dunlap here talking about the Pirates. Colin, this is something that you'll be dealing with in a couple, 3 months, or at least you'll be hearing a lot about, and that's the draft. The Pirates have the number one overall pick. And Dejan did a story for the Post-Gazette last week on MLB prospect and the presumed number one pick, although it's not certainly not a lock, Anthony Rendon, the third baseman at Rice. You've read about this guy. You've heard some stuff about him. I mean, is this a guy that the Pirates are going to invest a lot in like they did Alvarez? Are they going to have to make that kind of investment in another young player? And do you think that player will be Rendon from everything you've been hearing?
Well, he's going to be a Boris guy, and Dejan extracted that from him, last week. They're going to have to pay him. But that said, is it thoroughly convinced like how Bryce Harper was last year, that he is far and above the number one guy at this point? I mean, his health would be a little bit of a concern. How he's going to perform with that bat is going to be a little bit of a concern. In the end, he's probably going to be the number one guy. But I don't think that he's clear and above and far and above and has distanced himself how some other guys have in past years as the number one guy. Again, I think it'll trickle back to where, yes, he'll end up being the number one guy, and they will have to pay him because who he's aligned himself with in terms of an agent. And I think that, yes, in terms of a PR hit, if they were to draft him, they're going to have to pay him. And it will be big, big money. It just comes with the territory with a guy like that. But I think that people need to let the evaluation process sort of play out because, again, he is not – the expanse isn't as wide from everything that I've read and the things that I've seen on television even. The expanse isn't as wide between the number one and the number two and three picks as it has been in years past.
A couple pitchers, specifically really hard-throwing guys, Gerrit Cole, Matt Perk, are college pitchers that throw close to 100. When you look overall at the Major League Baseball draft and then in free agency, the cost of starting pitching, elite starting pitching, is enormous in free agency. It's very, very difficult for a team like the Pirates under any circumstance, under any ownership, to get that. So that's a thought process that they're having very seriously. And Chris, let me ask you, what do you think, even if it's established that Cole or Perk is a possible or a realistic number one, would be the reaction if a Rendon wasn't taken or was bypassed?
I think the fans here want to see a guy that can hit home runs, and this is maybe where it's to the detriment, that the fan sentiment isn't the accurate one, but you want to see somebody that is presumed to be, because everyone reads the Baseball America list.
Yeah,
everyone
hears, he's not a great power guy, though,
he projects more as a guy that could hit maybe 20 homers in the bigs, but he's an average guy.
20 to 25,
and he's going to drive in runs because he's just a good hitter with a good eye. That's the book that I've read on him, that he's got a tremendous hitting eye. I think if the Pirates were to go in a different direction than that, people would just automatically, because of their history with some drafting pitchers number one, they'd say, oh, it's another Bullington, because even if they hear that Gerrit Cole can throw at 100 miles an hour, throw it through a brick wall, they just think of the history and they say, well, Alvarez did okay. Remember the walk-off home run? Let's get another bopper. I honestly feel that that's how fans look at it, and I kind of can't blame them, because there's two ways to be bad in the major leagues. You cannot be able to pitch like the Texas Rangers couldn't for so long, or you cannot be able to hit like the Pirates haven't been able to do very often.
Actually, and Chris, they found three ways to be bad last
year.
When you're last in ERA, batting average, and fielding percentage, you've hit the trifecta.
But traditionally, I think for a lot of fans, I guess what I'm angling at here is that over 18 years, when you just can't put runs on the board a lot, and that seems to be the battle cry or the rallying cry, that's more frustrating than anything. Like, at least if you're hitting the ball, you're losing in a somewhat entertaining manner.
We're with on the roundtable here with Colin Dunlap, Pirates beat reporter for the Post-Gazette, and I've got less than a minute, so Colin, I'm going to start this with you, but I'm going to ask Dejan and Chris this too. The Cubs have named Ryan Dempster their starter for the regular season opener against the Pirates. Is there any reason the Pirates should not name Paul Mahalan their own number one? Are they prepared to do that, do you think?
I think in the end it may end up being him, but why not let the process trickle out just a little bit? I don't think you have to at this point right now need to get on a schedule to name that guy the starter at Wrigley. I think you can let it play out for another week or so, or for at least a few more days. I just don't think you have to do it right now, and I think that it can be a motivational tool to sort of light a spark under some of those other guys. What if Kevin Correa goes out and pitches very well? What if James McDonald does perform very well in the next week or so. That I don't see the benefit in doing it if you're the Pirates. Maybe if you're the Cubs, yeah, there is a benefit in doing it to sort of generate some excitement. But if you're the Pirates, let the competition play out a little bit. But I do think it will be Mahalo.
Colin, and I think that partially that's because Paul Mahalem has pitched very well at Wrigley Field, and I think Clint Hurdle is a little bit more pragmatic in this particular case.
It'll be Mahalem, but I'm still holding out hope myself for Charlie Morton.
Okay. Colin, thanks a lot for the knowledge, and we'll see you when you get back for a few days and you come back to Pittsburgh.
Surely. No problem,
all right,
guys.
Thanks. Colin Dunlap from the Post-Gazette. Next up, we read fan mail. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
You're listening to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. It's time for fan mail on the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. Time now for our fan mail segment. And if you'd like to have your email read on our show, please email me at jmicco@post-gazette.com. That's jmicco@post-gazette.com. We'll consider it for a future show. This week's letter is from Jim, who writes, I've been a Penguin fan since the beginning of the Lemieux era. However, I must admit that I am having a more difficult time being an ardent fan of the Pens with Matt Cook as a member of the team. The man takes cheap shots every opportunity he gets with total disregard for the opposing player. If he hurts them, so what? I have three kids that play youth hockey. Each season, I witness a number of kids being taken off the ice on stretchers as a result of cheap shots made by dirty players. A four-game suspension for Cook's most recent cowardly hit was not enough. More needs to be done. Whether it comes from the league office or the Penguin organization itself, more needs to be done. Only when it is will the number of young kids being rolled out on stretchers begin to decline. Well, Jim, thanks for the letter. You know, it's the thing about hockey. Hockey's a rough sport. It's a violent sport. Sometimes you can get a kid wheeled off in a game from a non-dirty hit. It's a collision sport. Now, that doesn't mean I condone dirty hits. I don't think anybody does. I think Matt Cook plays that game on the edge. I think the Penguins like that. I think Ulf Samuelsson was another Penguin who played that game on the edge, and I think people like that. Some people would say Alex Ovechkin plays that game on the edge, and Capitals fans will tell you they love everything about his game. I think that's just part of the game. Now, I don't condone it, nor do I necessarily agree with it. I think the league is trying very slowly to get that part of the game under control. They took the blindside head hits out of the game and supposedly did. And a lot of people in Pittsburgh would say, well, what happened to Sidney Crosby? He got blindsided by Dave Steckel, and he got hit from behind by Hedman from Tampa Bay. So where was the protection there? Well, the Hedman hit was a penalty, and Crosby, you know, and it's never been proven or anything, but, you know, the severity of that concussion obviously is showing since Sid's still not playing. I think what the league needs to do is continue to take hits from behind and to take head hits, and you're right. I think it's suspensions. It's not fines. It's not, you know, warnings. It is suspensions, and maybe Cooks is a start. Maybe they need to look at more of these and say, that hit was, you know, that was a dirty hit, and you're going to pay the price for it. It's going to cost you some money. It's going to cost you four games. It's going to cost you eight. It's going to cost you 10. So the league does need to continue to be more proactive. I think they've taken a couple of tiny steps. I think a lot more needs to be taken, but when a player like Matt Cook is out there, you know, from the vast majority of Penguin fans, they'd rather have him on his team or on your team rather than have him going against someone else. That's just the sign of the times. That's just the way the NHL operates as of right now. That does it for today's Post-Gazette Roundtable. I'd like to thank today's panel, 93.7 The Fan, late shift host Chris Muller and the PG's Dejan Kovacevic, and to our guests, PG Penguins beat writer Shelly Anderson and the PG's Pirates beat writer Colin Dunlap. Also, many thanks to our producer Matt Popchuk, who does wonders putting this show together for us every week. I hope you'll join us on the Roundtable next Saturday morning on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm Jerry Micco, Post-Gazette Sports Editor. Have a great week, everyone.